the J-Talk Podcast.
Yosh.
Can you hear me? Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. Coming up, our 2018 J1 season preview, but I'd like to begin this episode with an apology for the audio problems in our J2 preview episode posted last week. A lot of listeners reached out to say the volume level was too low throughout the podcast, a concern I had throughout the editing process that unfortunately rang true for many people. I'm using new recording software on a different computer than I had used previously, but hopefully the issue will be fixed from this episode forward. I'd also like to apologise to Tokyo Verde supporters for the hatchet job I did on the J2 preview pod, cutting out pretty much all mention of the Tokyo Greens, who deserved their moment in the sun for their terrific fifth place finish last season. Rest assured, John Steele was effusive in his praise for Verde, but a couple of careless clicks from me saw all that hit the cutting room floor. I promise, not a cross-Tokyo bias from an FC Tokyo fan. Okay, so we move on, and with the J1 season kicking off on Friday night, Sean Carroll and Scott McIntyre join me to preview the top flight season. The J-Talk podcast starts now. It's the J-Talk J1 preview, and it's an all-star cast. Sean Carroll and Scott McIntyre have joined me. Firstly, Sean, welcome back to J-Talk. It's great to speak to you again.
Welcome back to you, mate. It's good to have you back.
Outstanding. Very nice. Thank you very much. And Scott, now a podcast superstar in his own right, thanks to the Asian game that he's started up with Paul Williams in the last year. Scott, welcome back to J-Talk.
And same to you. I was going to say it's great to have you back as well, but when I heard Sean say it, I thought that he meant he was actually looking out for you during the time that you've been absent. But it is good to have the pod back.
Well, it's very nice. And how have you found getting one started and, keeping it running in the last few months?
No, I've got to say Paul down in Australia does most of the technical side of things, so I've got the easy bit of just sitting in front of the microphone and talking. So, it's all credit there.
Tremendous stuff. And, yes, the Asian Game is the name, and it's a cracking podcast. I'm sure most of the listeners of J-Talk are already well and truly familiar with it. But if you're not, get listening. Gentlemen, we're here to preview the 2018 J1 season, but first, let's take a few minutes to look back at what happened in 2017. Of course, there was no J-Talk last season. And I don't know if I picked the right year to take the year off or I picked the wrong year because everything's upside down all of a sudden. Kawasaki are J1 champions and Cerezo did the cup double, both of those clubs winning their first ever top flight trophies. I guess we better start with Kawasaki and... Sean, I guess we better let Scott talk about Kawasaki, his passion project for so many years, of course, with when Yahiro Kazuma was at the controls of the good ship Frontale. He hopped off to Nagoya, and lo and behold, Frontale finally went and won not only a trophy, but the biggest trophy of all, Scott.
Yeah, well, I think my passion project was more about Kazuma, and we'll get onto that when we talk about Nagoya a little bit later, because he basically hopped down to J2 and did exactly what he'd been doing at Kawasaki, you know, scoring 1,000 goals and shipping a fair few at the same time. So it was no surprise that, you know, you had Toru Oniki, who'd been his long-time assistant, step in and basically just had the side better organized. I mean, they still had the same thrust, the same mentality in attack going forward, but he had them more discipline, more responsibility, if you want, in terms of their defensive work. You know, when they went a goal or two up, they didn't push to make that three or four. They were content to, you know, not sit and see out games, but make sure that they did what they needed to do to get the points when they needed them. And you saw that over the season add up, you know, as they kind of ran Kashima down over the final stretch to win that title. And I think it was a justified one. You know, we saw the class still that they have going forward, but they were much better in an overall defensive sense. But I think, you know, not just looking at it from the back, I think a lot of that started from the central midfield positions. For me, Eduardo Neto is a fantastic player, and he gets little a kind of a credit or plaudits, you know, does a great work in terms of screening you know, in the center of the field, which allows Oshima to push forward. But he's also very good in his distribution as well. He was immense and a real key part of that title push. Of course, Kenga Nakamura, we all know, is just getting better and better, amazingly, as he gets older. He was a key component of that. Yuka Kobayashi, who for me, I still don't know if he's a striker or if he's a winger or what he is. Seems like a nice guy, but you know, I'm still somehow surprised that he scored this many goals, but he has. And you know, he's like a good service from out wide. The fullbacks were good. They were better in central defence than they probably ever have been, and they've got, you know, a solid if not spectacular keeper. So a very good side, and you know, overall I think a justified title.
And Sean, yeah, remarkable that they did it by staring into the eyes of the beast, i.e. Kashima. Obviously, antlers, deers aren't the most threatening of animals for the most part. But yes, we all know that antlers are serial title winners. And with a four-point lead with just two games left in the season, obviously it looked done and dusted, and that Frontale were going to end the season again without any silverware to show for it. But yeah, they looked into the eyes of the beast, and they won the Battle of Wills against Antlers, who obviously drew 0-0 in their final two games, while Frontale just ran amok.
You've obviously never been to Nara, mate, if you think that deer...
I was going to make the exact same joke, Sean.
Good Lord. Who's joking? The things are terrifying.
Well, yes, I have had half a T-shirt eaten off there. I will admit that, yeah.
But yeah, you're right. Everyone assumed that it was Antlers in the bag. Even I think Kawasaki, I forget when it was exactly, because all the games were kind of mixed up towards the end, but they had an away game against Reds in sort of midweek that was their makeup game, and if they hadn't won that, Antlers would have won the league anyway. It just looked like a matter of if not when Antlers won it, and like you said, for them to ultimately choke and draw both their last games, and all they needed was one goal in either of them to win the title. But I actually agree entirely with Scott. I think for Kawasaki, Eduardo Neto was vital. The amount of, if you look at the stats from their games, he's just involved in everything, the sort of pass combination stats. He's constantly receiving the ball from the centre backs, playing it around, and he kind of was the sort of pivot in the middle that enabled everyone else to go about their game. And yeah, I mean, they were given a helping hand in the end by the fact that Kashima stumbled so badly, but I don't think there'd be many people, maybe Steve Ballmer's side, who were disappointed to see Kawasaki finally win something. Even if they didn't get their hands on any actual silverware on the last day, they had to make do with that sort of print-out cardboard thing, because
sure,
the original shield was down in Iwata for Kashima to lift.
Indeed. And yes, obviously, I've poked a lot of fun at Frontale over the years on J-Talk for their inability to rise to the occasion when it really mattered. So absolutely have to hold my hands up and say yes, a thoroughly well-deserved title. As we've all said, yeah, it looked like it was Antlers for the taking, but Frontale weren't taking no for an answer. And yes, they have a first ever top flight title, and it is the J1 Championship. And we'll obviously come on to our preview of this season to see how they get on defending it. But yes, Scott, you mentioned Yu Kobayashi there, the winner of the Golden Boot, a hat-trick in the final game, the 5-0 win over Omiya, saw him overtake Kenyu Sugimoto. We've already mentioned Antlers a little bit there, so we might skip to the team that finished third and also won their first top flight titles, the Levain Cup and then the Emperor's Cup on New Year's Day. So, as I said, Sean, the league's just been turned upside down with all these teams winning their first trophies. For Cerezo, a promoted team, obviously, coming up after being promoted through the playoffs at the end of the 2016 J2 season. I actually had them fourth in my preseason predictions last year, one of the few things I got right last year. I wasn't expecting them to go all that far in the cups, though, because I thought the league might have taken up most of their exertions. But, yeah, absolutely tremendous result from the pink half of Osaka to come away with their first two trophies as well as finishing third. They handled a number of different workloads and they did it in style.
Yeah, I think it was a bit similar to what Scott mentioned with Kawasaki. They had a coach who came in and kind of got them a bit more organised, and that's exactly what Yun Jong-hwan does with his teams. He massively overachieved when he was at Tosu. Again, after, you know, they'd come up from the second division, and he fundamentally gets them set up solid defensively and sort of hard to break down. And then, you know, with the amount of quality they've got the amount of very talented players of theirs that for one reason or another have all failed to last over in Europe and have all come back. You know, you've got, look at Yamaguchi, Kakitani, Kiyotake, those kind of players. When you've got them in your team, you've got sort of players that can decide games almost on their own. And similarly to what Scott said about Kazuma kind of teams, they were scoring a lot of goals, and then towards the end they were sort of struggling a bit, getting that balance of putting them in at one end, but they were starting to concede a few more towards the end of the season. But they're a very difficult team, I think, to break down. They sit back behind the ball in numbers. And then, like I said, once you're on the counter with that kind of artillery going forward. But yeah, I was surprised. I think I'm right in saying they won the cup without losing a game. And then to come third, and then the Levan Cup, that is. Mm-hmm. And then to come third and also win the Emperor's Cup as well. And I think looking at the squad they've got this year, they've pretty much kept everything in place. They've made a couple of additions to a sort of squad members, and you'd assume that they'll be in the mix again this year, in the league and again in the cups.
Indeed. And Scott, anything to add on the Cerezo? Did they surprise you? What sort of position did you have them finishing last year? I imagine they've exceeded pretty much everybody's expectations.
Yeah, certainly not as high as you had them, and I agree totally with Sean's assessment of how they play. And listeners have heard me on the podcast before, or you two are over beers in various locations, know they're not my kind of cup of tea when it comes to a stylistic approach to playing the game. I mean, I think you've got to give them credit over the league that they did well to finish where they did. They probably got a bit fortunate in terms of the Emperor's Cup. I think they had a very soft draw right the way through. I think they played only one J1 team until the latter end of the tournament, but you've got to beat what's put in front of you, and they did that. I don't think they did it with style, as you said. I think they did it with grit and grinding out results, which for me is a shame, because you look at the side that they have and the wealth of attacking talent that they have. We know that Kiyotake was injured for various parts of the season, and unfortunately he's down again. He's probably going to miss the first 6 weeks of this campaign as well, and who knows how many after that when he comes back. Credit, they did fantastically well in their return, but it wasn't like they were a minnow coming up with a squad that was challenged. I mean, they got a guy in Matej Onić, who for me was the best defender in the J-League last year. He actually earned that award in Korea the season he came over. You've got long-time established internationals, Yamaguchi, Kiyotake, we touched on, Sugimoto, Kakitani. I mean, in terms of just that amount of quality, and don't forget the fantastic keeper as well, Kim, a Korean international. So in terms of on paper, I mean, they probably had one of the best, you could argue the best kind of squad in J1. So, maybe it was a surprise to see them have that kind of success. Dare we forget, as long-time Cerezo fans will, of course, they did win three Emperor's Cups back in the JSL days when they were Yanmar Diesel, but mm-hmm. in the J-League era, this was their first title. So fair play to them.
All right, well, we'll obviously be working our way through pretty much all of the teams and how they got on in 2017 as we preview the 2018 season. But one more that we can't forget before we move on is, of course, the reigning Asian Champions League winners, Urawa Reds. They finished seventh in J1, but, of course, epically went all the way to the final of the ACL, where they defeated Al Hilal 2-1. On aggregate, thanks to the man who is no longer leading their front line, of course, Rafael Silva, who scored both goals in the final, as well as, I think, their winner in the semi as well against the Shanghai SIPG. A bit of a lost season in J1, Scott, but, I mean, you can't argue with a second continental title. And similarly to Kawasaki, of course, winning the big one after Kazuma left, it took Misha Petrovic to vacate his spot at Saitama Stadium for Reds to finally win the big one. And maybe he'd been holding them back all this time.
You know me, I can argue about anything, and indeed I will argue, because I think, yeah, I mean, there's a lot we can talk about. The fact that Horry won the Asian Coach of the Year is truly mind blowing. I think he you know, he won less than half of the 16 games he played when he was awarded that prize. You're going to be the podcast host of the year, Ben, if you keep this up after four episodes. But you look back at the quarterfinal, and, I mean, they were it was a game that Kawasaki – Sean and I were both at that game, and it was simply astonishing to watch what they did. I mean, they were 3-1 up from the first leg, and then they scored to make it 4-1 on aggregate, and then they copped a red card, and then – Oniki just made a series of truly mind-boggling substitutions. I mean, he bought Kengo off. Who was the other guy bought off? Abe or someone? And he just basically totally gave up on their attack, sat back, and they were run apart. But you can say if it wasn't for the red card, or even with the red card, if it wasn't for that, not just one, but two, three, four series of just astonishing tactical blunders, there was no way on God's green earth that Urawa were anywhere near getting through that tie. Mm. And then, okay, they went on and they won it. But no way were they the best team in the tournament, I don't think, and not even anywhere near it. And, you know, let alone to have a coach then go on and be crowned as coach of the year. I mean, okay, they did what they needed to do, but it was a series of monumental blunders in that quarterfinal from Kawasaki. It was the only reason that they progressed as far as they did in the tournament. And, you know, I'm sure, like I said, we'll get onto him in a minute. I'm still absolutely not convinced that Horry is the right man to lead them to the promised land.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, as you said, you were there with Sean. I mean, there's no denying what happened in the quarterfinals was nothing short of unbelievable. But, well, I don't know, Sean. All you can do is win the games in front of you. And after they beat Kawasaki, they obviously had two massive clubs in front of them, and Reds took care of business. And yeah, I mean, you can't argue with the winning the championship, can you?
Well, Scott, as we know, we'll try to.
Yeah.
I have to lean more on your side. Whereas, yeah, you can definitely say that Holly doesn't maybe set the team up to be the most expansive or most exciting. He certainly gave them a bit more structure, a bit more grit than they'd had under Petrovic. The way you changed the formation to four at the back with Alki just sat in front, it seemed like the players were more comfortable in the transitions then. They weren't really spectacular. But you saw, I think, with Reds, for me, the problem with Reds had always been there, similar to what you mentioned with Kawasaki, it was the mental side of things. Once they were within touching distance, and the manner in which, I mean, yeah, Scott's absolutely right. The Kawasaki game was, the second leg was just outrageous. I mean, Kawasaki were there. It was game over. It was unbelievable that Reds managed to come back in that. And you can praise them for coming back, but yeah, as Scott said, it was just Kawasaki completely crumbled in that game. But once they got into the semi-finals, you know, Shanghai had a very experienced, successful coach there. You know, everyone knows the big name players they've got there. Whereas they didn't really play as much of a team in previous years, Reds would have maybe been intimidated a bit by the occasion, but I was at both legs of the semi-final in Shanghai as well, and the way they managed to come from a goal down in that game and pick up a draw away from home and then see it out in the second leg, kept a clean sheet and just edged it 1-0, which is exactly what they did in the final as well. I can see Scott's point of view, especially knowing how much of a purist he is, shall we say, when it comes to how teams should play. But I have to agree with you. The way that Reds managed to hold their nerve and win it in the end, I think you have to give them credit for that.
Well, Scott, doesn't this make Kawasaki ultimately winning the J1 title even more unbelievable? Because yeah, they absolutely wilted in the ACL quarterfinals. Of course, I can't remember the exact timeline, but around the same time, or perhaps you know a month or so later, they were crumbling in the Levain Cup final against Cerezo, and it looked like this title curse was just going to roll on and on and on. Obviously, there's no winning culture there. As much as we laud Kengo Nakamura as, you know, being one of the truly all-time greats of Japanese football, I mean, he'd never won anything. The club had never won anything in J1. And then, as I say, stare into the eyes of the beast and come out on top in a head-to-head battle with Antlers is just remarkable. When you add those other two factors in, it's frankly unbelievable.
Yes, before I move on to that, I'm just going to touch one last thing on the Champions League. Even, I mean, leaving that Kawasaki game aside, they were absolutely murdered in games after that. The stats, they had 36% possession in both the first leg and the second leg, so absolutely, I I don't think they would deserve a champions in any way, shape or form, but that's what it is. But coming back to the Kawasaki part of it, I mean, it's often been the case with the club in one-off games that maybe they didn't know what to do. And I think you've already seen that, you know, even with the ACL this year, that in the first match at home, tactically they played very unusual, almost for the first half of the first match. They were content to sit back and almost be like a counter-attacking kind of team. It was very strange to see. And I just wonder whether, you know, Onyeki's figured out the best way to, you know, kind of approach these big one-off games, whereas in the league he was more comfortable with the system rolling along. You know, win the majority of your games. You might drop some here or there, but you've still got time to pick it up. So I think it was that consistency throughout the league when there wasn't really, you know, much at stake that served them well in that setting. But, yeah, tactically, you know, whether he's then quite figured out the best way to approach the one-off games, particularly the games in Asia. I don't know, honestly, if he has, and, you know, that might also hurt them in those kind of situations this year as well.
All right, then. Well, I was going to ask you each for a surprising and a disappointing club from the 2017 season. Maybe we could work that in to our, well, as we're not going to go team by team exactly, but we're obviously going to mention each team as we work our way through the league. In our 2018 preview. So if you want to throw in whether that particular team surprised you or disappointed you in 2017, then we might be able to do it in that fashion. Or we could get it out of the way and say that FC Tokyo was the most disappointing team for all of us. Or does anybody else have another nomination?
FC Tokyo weren't disappointing, but they went pretty much like they do every year.
Well, after the they'd at least sold me on the six in inverted commas big name transfers that they'd brought on board, and I thought I would never have a better chance to pick them to win the league, so I went ahead and did it. And well, I guess I shouldn't be surprised that they finished 12th, but 13th. Oh no, you're right. It was, wasn't it? It was even worse than that. Yeah.
Unlucky.
Yes.
But yeah, you're right. Actually, they did with that front line. They should really have done better, but. To say they were sort of surprised to finish down there is, I don't know, maybe that's a bit of a stretch because they did what FC Tokyo do.
Fair enough. I'm obviously biased, but you imagine supporters of every other club or every other neutral would probably say the same. We're obviously blinkered, Scott, but anyway, it was disappointing, but what can I say? All right. We've spoken at length about Kawasaki already. I guess we can get them out of the way. What can they do for an encore, Scott? What are your expectations? Where sort of ballpark do you have them finishing in this year?
Oh, they're in my bracket of contenders. I'd be surprised if they fell, you know, outside of the top four. But the situation is always how these clubs are going to go in terms of having a balance, you know, competing on the continent and then coming back and competing domestically as well, particularly, you know, given the fact that we've got this rather lengthy World Cup break this year. I mean, it's almost, I know we got away from the two-stage thing, but it's almost got a feeling of that's where we're at, you know. I mean, I've spoken to a couple of coaches and they've already said, you know, that basically they're treating it that way as two separate kind of seasons. You know, they might give the, you know, a 2-3 week you know, even a break for the squad to go away in the middle of the year, you know, refresh, or some might do a mini pre-season. So if we look at especially that first you know, spell from March through to May, there's a hell of a lot of games are coming. Of course, the other teams are playing cup games, but they'll have the luxury of rotating through those, whereas the four ACL clubs will not only have the travel to factor in, but likely, or you would hope, that most of them would, you know, run with their regular squads as much as they can as well. So, I mean, that's, you know, it's an issue of concern for Kawasaki as it is for the other three ACL teams. But if you look at their squad, I mean, they didn't really lose anyone of note. They've had the luxury of sending several of the promising youngsters out on loan to various other clubs, and they brought in, you know, a couple of impressive players. I mean, particularly Yoshito Okubo, who was like a fish out of water with Tokyo last year. I think I remember saying to you, Ben, after one of the first games, just watching him running around and berating his teammate, you know, almost what we saw with Podolski when he came in, and that, you know, I said to you, this is not going to work because he almost came in with this. Well, he obviously came in with the reputation as the league's all-time scorer, but you don't know what kind of attitude that came, and whether he really wanted to be there in the first place. I don't know what went on with the whole transfer, but he already seems, in the couple of glimpses we've had of him back at Frontale, to be happy, you know, where he is. He's already scored for them, and he looks right back at home. So, he may not be a starter. I mean, and, you know, that's a hell of a luxury if you've got a player with that kind of pedigree and ability to have, you know, coming off the bench for you and really turning games. So they're absolutely, you know, going to be a contender as they were last year.
And Sean, yeah, would you agree with that sentiment? Would you have them in your top four as well?
I would say top four. I don't know. Maybe put them, if I split the league into three, I'd probably say top six. I can see them challenging. They'll be up there. But yeah, I'm a little bit, I wouldn't say concerned, but the players they've brought in Okubo. They've also obviously brought in Manabu Saito from Marinos, which was a surprising signing to say the least. Not just because he was the captain of their rivals who would come through their youth team, but it doesn't really, at first glance, doesn't really seem to fit with Kawasaki's style. He's more of a kind of, you know, players on his own, gets his head down and tries to charge through and make stuff happen, whereas Kawasaki are more about building up with, you know, intricate, quick passing. So it's an interesting signing, and it's just how they're going to manage, or how Oniki's going to manage to keep all those players. As Scott touched on there, Okubo's obviously got a reputation, a bit of an ego. And if you've got the likes of him, you've got Ienaga, you've got Saito, you've got Kobayashi, you've got Kengo, you've got a youngster, Moriya and Hasegawa. And, you know, you've got all these players, Abe as well. Hiroyuki is a very good player who did really well for them last year. And, you know, looks like maybe he might lose out on minutes this year because he's not as big a name almost. And it's getting that chemistry right. You can't read too much into the Super Cup game, but they definitely didn't click in that. I was at their ACL match, the first group game against Shanghai as well, and they didn't really look like they were clicking just yet. And it's, you know, the proper season hasn't started yet. These things take time. But, they'll be up there, I think. I'd be very surprised if they really dropped off. But similarly, I'd personally be surprised if they were to win the league again, or, you know, to make a real concerted challenge.
All right, then. Well, let me take the listeners behind the fourth wall here. Before we started recording, Scott said that he'd actually got the table mapped out. He knows how it's going to finish at the end of the season. You mentioned you had Kawasaki in your top four there, Scott. So why don't we cut the suspense and we can begin discussing teams in some sort of order. So who else do you have in your top four?
Do you want to take a guess? I've got one obvious one and perhaps two less obvious ones.
Obvious means they finished in the top four last year?
Yeah.
Well, I would say you have Cerezo in your top four. Is that right?
No.
Okay. Sean, you want to take a punt?
Surely Kashima.
Yeah.
Okay. Because?
And the curveball, I'm going to go for Nagoya.
Correct.
Nagoya's in the top four. Okay.
Correct.
And Yokohama.
Correct.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, well,
oh, of course.
We've mentioned Manabu Saito there. He's left Yokohama to join Kawasaki. Yokohama, arguably their biggest signing of the off-season, was former Australian manager Ange Postecoglou. Scott, so is he the answer for F. Marinos? What do you think in terms of building on what Eric Mombatz has done over the past couple of seasons? Will he look to build on that, or will he look to break it all down and start again?
Yeah, I think it's firmly the latter. I mean, I think already in pre-season, you know, I've known Ange reasonably well for a long time, and you know, everywhere that he's gone, he's had success, and he's had success doing it in the way that, you know, I personally appreciate as well, by playing a very positive, attack-minded brand of football. And I think right from, you know, the start of pre-season, since he came in, although, you know, the squad was largely in place before he got there, but you know, I mean, I think the formation's going to change, and certainly the mentality is going to change. The fitness base is going to change to have to adapt to the way that he wants the team to play. And I really think that I really think they have the ability, they have the potential to take the league by storm. But I caution that with the fact that it's going to take time, as it has. You know, we've seen with Ange at different junctures in the past. It takes time to get that message across, to get that mentality across, and particularly it's perhaps a way that a lot of these players haven't been exposed to or been asked to play before. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if they started quite slowly in terms of results. You know, I think from, you know, hearing a few things in and around the club that, you know, they're quite happy with how our pre-season has been going. They're very happy with how the players have been responding to what they've been trying to do. But there's also recognition that, you know, that it is a process that's not going to be an immediate one. So, you know, could I see a situation where they really struggled for the first 6 or 7 games and questions are kind of starting to be asked? Yes, I can. And if, as I expect will be the case, the club, if that were to happen, sticks with them, I think when it clicks, it's going to click in a very, very impressive manner. And you're going to see a side that has the ability to really blow the league away. I mean, they may be ultimately hamstrung by what I suspect could be a slow start. But I think over the back end of the season, they're going to be a hell of a team. And if we look at it generally speaking, I know we can sit here and we can argue in detail about this player and that player and the depth here, there and everywhere, but compare it to other leagues around the world. The J-League is a league where parity is very, very close, I think, from top to bottom, relatively speaking. You know, we've seen many, many occasions of clubs coming up from J2 and not just doing well, but actually winning the title. It's the kind of thing that you don't see in almost any other league around the world. But I think really what makes the difference is coaching. And from what I know of Ange, and having watched him very, very closely and haven't spoken to him for a long period of time, it's not just Ange. I can tell you his support staff, his assistant coach, and the other guys that are here with him are also top-notch, top-notch elite football people. And I don't think the J-League has ever seen a coach as good as Ange Postecoglou. And I think that's going to make a hell of a difference, once it all starts to click.
Well, yeah, that's fascinating, and it's really going to be interesting to see what sort of impact he has on the squad, Sean. Of course, I mean, Yokohama had a season not to be sniffed at all last season, rising from 10th to 5th. I mean, they were 3rd with 4 games to go, but only won 1 of their last 4. So they missed out on the ACL. That might end up being a blessing in disguise, as it'll obviously give Postecoglou a chance to work more closely with his players without having to worry about, you know, stressful midweek games in the ACL. Obviously, there will be some Levain Cup commitments, of course, but, obviously we'll see a lot of the second string there. But, yeah, Sean, it's going to be fascinating to see how far he can take them.
Yeah, it is. I obviously don't know as much about how the new coach works as Scott or probably yourself, but, you know, I've only ever heard good things about him. He obviously did very well with the Australian national team and seemingly before that in the A-League as well, although I'm not too clued up on that. I just think, first of all, you know, he's obviously done well before in Australia, but he's now in a different country, and where, you know, the way getting his methods across, making sure the players pick them up, is something that, as Scott mentioned, sort of touched upon there, it might take a bit of time. And I just, yeah, I wonder as well, like, looking at their squad, they don't really seem to have, you know, they lost, I know the style of play is obviously going to change. Last year they were dependent upon the pace and the directness of Martinez and Manabu Saito out wide. They've both gone, so you're looking at a complete change in style. The two key creative players have gone in terms of the previous style they played. It looks like Amano is going to play a far more central role this year, and he's a very, very good player. But you look at the squad and it seems a little bit thin on the ground. I spoke to Ange briefly at the J-League has like calls it a kickoff conference where every coach and one player from each club go along and gather at a posh hotel, and you can accost them and ask them questions. And I asked him about the squad and if it was in the shape it's in because he was happy with it or because they just hadn't found the players that they wanted to bring in. And he was sort of vague, and he said they are still looking for one more foreigner. And it seemed like a lot of the business was done before it was all agreed that he was going to come in. He sort of hinted at the fact that because they got to the Emperor's Cup final, it took a bit of time out of the sort of changeover between Mombay Edson and himself, mm-hmm. because he said he didn't want to tread on the previous coach's toes and be getting too involved while they still had matches to come. So I'd have a little bit of hesitation just looking at their squad in comparison to others in the J-League. But, yeah, I actually tipped them last year to be an outside chance of pushing for the ACL. I think, yeah, they'll be – I'd probably have them up in my – my top six, or definitely sort of top seven or eight, and in around certainly looking for an ACL place again. But I'm not quite as optimistic as Scott is about their chances for the time being. But yeah, I don't think they'll drop off massively.
Any rebuttal there, Scott, or are we okay to move on?
No, I agree. I mean, I think if you look at the squad on paper, it's certainly, you know, nowhere near the equal of, you could even say, I don't know, seven, eight, maybe nine other clubs. But, you know, what they do have is a lot of young, I think it's probably, I mean, if we excuse the veteran defensive leader, I think it's probably the youngest squad in the league. There's a lot of youth products that have come up, been promoted into the top team. I think you're right, Sean touched on the departures, but, you know, you look at some of the arrivals. I think Yunil Lok, the Korean international who's in his mid-20s, an established Korean international, a fantastic a player, probably looking for an opportunity to maybe grow away from Korea. I think he's he's got the potential to be one of the best players in the league this season. I agree. I think, you know, Armano dropping back, it looks like they're going to play a 4-3-3 with, you know, one deeper midfielder and then the two more traditional central midfielders. If he operates in one of those roles, if Babunski manages to win one of those roles, maybe he will, maybe he won't. But, you know, he's a player of fantastic potential as well. And then two very exciting young fullbacks as well. So, you know, there may be question marks in goal. And this is a particular issue with, you know, the way that Ange likes to have his team playing, where, you know, you have the keeper who's very comfortable on the ball and is a key part of starting the attacks. They played FC Tokyo in the final warm-up match, and I think it was from, you know, one of those situations where the keeper was trying to play out that they lost possession and ultimately conceded in that game. So if they can, you know, address that position, you know, maybe bring in another foreign player in a more advanced a kind of attacking midfielder role, as Sean suggested, and, you know, slowly start to get the balance right, it'll certainly help. But yeah, like I said, I really firmly believe that there's never been as good a coach in the history of the J-League as what Ange Postecoglou is, and ultimately that's going to make a hell of a difference.
All right then. Well, there, I hope that's got all of the Yokohama F Mariners supporters who listen to the pod salivating. And, yes, as I've said numerous times, fascinating to see how Postecoglou will get on at the helm of the good ship F Marinos. Probably don't need to spend a great deal of time on the Kashima, as we've mentioned them a fair bit already, Scott, but you have them in your top four. Any sort of a worry about the way that they let this title slip out of their hands? Will act as a bit of a hangover in 2018, or will they be just that more motivated to get back what they believe is rightly theirs? And at the same time, are you slightly concerned that the likes of Yuma Suzuki and Shoma Doi haven't really kicked on? Obviously, Suzuki.
Well, he's your project, isn't he?
He is indeed. Shoma's my boyfriend. We'll obviously come on to yours a little bit later, but yes, Shoma not. Well, yeah, not where I would have expected him to be honest, 2 years ago. I mean, for various reasons, obviously, that, he hasn't quite hit the heights I imagined he would have. But, yeah, Suzuki was in the headlines, obviously, for his Club World Cup heroics. But last year, again, I think it was just six league goals. And, his starts were limited. Obviously, while Mu Kanazaki's there, you probably can't argue a great deal with that, but is this going to be a key year for his development? And I think I've asked you three questions there in once, but yeah, you can. I'm sure you can handle it.
I think we've spoken about this before, that I'm a massive fan of Yuma Suzuki, and I'm a little bit surprised he actually stayed one at the club. I honestly think he's good enough. If I was coaching the national team, I'd have him in the World Cup. I've said it before. I think he's a totally different kind of striker to anything that Japan has. I mean, you look at what I keep saying, that the barometer of things that I test this with is how many players, if they are involved in a collision with another player, go over and check on their welfare. And Yuma Suzuki strikes me as the kind of player who just doesn't care. He's a physical kind of player. He gets in your head, and he loves scoring goals. And he's the kind of player, it's going to hurt someone, he'll go ask about it at the end of the game, but he's going to get up and try and score goals. He's not, you know, a lovely, you know, upstanding citizen like, you know, the Kobayashis of the world that's going to go over and pat the guy on the back and, you know, be helping him off in the stretch and all this kind of thing. This is what you want in a striker. You want this this special instinct and desire, you know, the craving to push an old lady out of the way to score. And for me, that's the kind of, you know, elements that Suzuki has to his game. Unfortunately, we haven't seen enough. I'm surprised that a European club hasn't come calling for him, because I think he'd be a huge success overseas. I think he's one of the best forwards that Japan has anyway going around. And, you know, like I said, the fact is he's going to be probably reduced to ACL duties and maybe cup games this year as well. It was an embarrassment of riches up front. You know, maybe, you know, your boy Shoma looks like he could be one of the contenders to play alongside Kanazaki up front. I think that's maybe, in terms of his development, one of the problems. Is he a winger? Is he a central player? Is he a striker? And is he just a nice guy? I mean, he's another, to me, seems like another nice guy. So I don't know if, you know, that's the ultimate qualities if you want to be a striker and take it to the next level. So, but you're looking at the squad as a whole, it's the headline arrival. It's not often a right fullback is that player, but Atsuta Uchida has certainly caught a lot of attention. He's going to help them at the back. Daigo Nishi's out anyway for a couple of months with injury, so he stepped straight in and covered that issue. They brought in some fantastic depth at almost all key positions. They brought Leandro back on a full-time deal, converted his loan into a permanent transfer. Ogasawara seems now to be a squad player with Masao firmly established, another guy that, you know, could and probably should be in the World Cup reckoning. And then, you know, the fantastic force it is, Leo Silva in central midfield. And, you know, if they can sort out their issues at the back, I mean, last year it was supposed to be the Korean Kwon that came in, then Sogahara got a chance through injury and kind of never relinquished that role. He's looked a bit shaky in the ACL to date. So that's probably the only kind of area of the pitch, you know, where there's a little bit of uncertainty if they've got the quality that they need. But basically, you know, across the pitch, they've got wonderful depth. They've got, you know, massive options at almost every position. I mean, it's hard to see where they're going to go wrong, especially, say, last year, all the issues that went on, you know, with the transfer of the coaching from, you know, Ishii, if you believe the rumours that, you know, he wasn't the most popular figure in and around the club, and they were almost waiting for the moment to strike and get rid of him. You know, they've had Go Oiwa come in and now and do a fantastic job, you know, showing that he's got what it takes to be the guy at this level. So, yeah, it's hard to find too many holes in the whole situation with Kashima and you know, who's going to beat them?
Fair enough. Sean, yeah, I mean, he makes a decent case there, and they've obviously got the pedigree. I'm wondering whether there'll be any sort of a hangover, but it's such a long season with the World Cup in amongst it as well that, yeah, I mean, quality will win out in the end, and I'm sure they'll be in the reckoning.
Yeah, basically everything that you two have just said, they're always up there. They're always in the mix. The depth they've got in the squad is, you know, pretty much every position. They've got two players of almost identical quality that can come in. You know, you sort of mentioned that they've got the likes of Shoma Doi and Yuma Suzuki that are sort of, you know, they probably walk into three quarters of the rest of J1 teams and be regulars. And, you know, somehow Kashima always managed to kind of keep those fringe players motivated. So when they do come in and get their chances, they usually take them. When you can add someone like Uchida as the backup right back, if you want, for until Nishi comes back, or, you know, they'll, you know, you've both, even if when Nishi's back again, if you've got Nishi as a backup, there's two, you know, very, very good good right backs there. You look at the whole defence, yeah, the whole way through the side. I spoke a bit to Kento Misao, their defensive midfielder, at the aforementioned kickoff conference the other day, and I asked him which player he thought could be the difference maker for them this year. If, you know, I asked him if one player does well, and that could spur you on, who do you think could be the difference? And he actually said Suzuki. He said, I really think he could be the, you know, the guy most likely to score for us this season. I believe he can get about 20 goals. He's really got that threat. I think last year he only scored 6 times in the league. Yeah. So if he can build on the potential he showed a couple of years ago and really start to get a run in the team and find his form. I mean, they only missed out on the title last year by one goal. I know that if you look at the goal difference, it wasn't just one. But if they'd scored in either of their last two games and won either of those nil-nils, they'd have been champions. And as Scott said, you know, you're looking through the table, who else can you see maintaining the same consistency as Antlers? Okay, they slipped up at the end last year. But, yeah, I would personally have them as one of my my picks if someone put a gun to my head and asked me to call it now. I think, yeah, Kashima, looking at the lay of the land at the moment, they'd have to be one of the favourites to be winning it.
Fair enough. Well, before we leave Antlers, I'd just like to state for the record, Scott, I don't think that Sean Modoy would push a granny out of the way to score a goal. I think he'd prefer to dribble around her and, you know, just leave her in peace. But that's if Yuma Suzuki's going to play like that, well, I don't know. I don't know if I want to be associated with a player like that. But, yeah, anyway.
Who's the closest we've got? Who's the closest we've got in J1 to a granny in centre-back? Who would you say?
Well, it'd have to be Nakazawa, but I mean, he's still a fantastic player, but he's getting up there in age. He's pretty much the only one you could compare to, I guess.
Yeah, you're probably right. Tulio's down in J2 now, isn't he? And he's a centre forward. So, and you certainly wouldn't call Tulio a granny to his face or otherwise.
No, not at all. Well, I wasn't going to. Well, I didn't think. Sorry, that we'd be talking about Nagoya this early in our 2018 J1 season preview, Scott. But you've plumped for them in your top four, and I can see why. Well, I don't know what you're going to say, but I mean, in the last three seasons, we've had a team come up from J2 and finish in the top half of the table. Of course, Shonan 8th in 2015, Omiya 5th in 2016, was, of course, they were both relegated the season after those two performances. And then, yes, Cerezo, the aforementioned Cerezo, third and winning two cups last season. So there's definite history for that. Of course, Kashiwa and Gamba have won J1 after coming up from J2. So, yeah, there's all sorts of history in that regard with teams coming up from the second tier. What is it in particular about Nagoya that, that has you thinking that they could finish all the way up in the top four?
I think it's a multifaceted thing, and let's not kid ourselves again that this is a small club, right? This is one of the giants of certainly the early years of the J-League, but a traditional giant of Japanese football, incredibly strong backing from wealthy owners, a wonderful coach. As you know, I'm ticket holder number one in the Yohiro Kazama fan club, and I think without question, I said, Andrew's going to be the best coach we've seen, but I think for me, in terms of stylistically, the way the adherence to a philosophy and one that I agree with, I don't think there's been a better coach. I know there's been many more that have won a lot of titles, and many of them have done so in fairly pragmatic manner. But for a consistent run of success, not in terms of titles, but in terms of being competitors year in, year out, and doing it with the same methodology. There hasn't been another guy in the J-League era like Yahiro Kazama, another local guy who's done that. So you've got that element. We saw as soon as he went down to J1, 1 year at the club and boom, again, it took a little bit of a while to get it going, but then they went through that run of games, late in the summer where you touched on it in the J2 preview last week, but they were, scoring, I think it was 4 or 5 weeks where they scored 5, 6, 7 goals every single game, and they were just blazing teams apart. That coincided with the arrival of a guy that Sean's watched a lot more than me in Gabriel Xavier, who was clearly far too good for J2. You factor in the additions this year as well. Another guy that I know fairly well, the Australian goalkeeper, Mitch Langerak, who spent a long time as basically a number two at a couple of massive clubs in Germany, went across to Spain, that didn't work out. And I mean, he's a brilliant shot stopper. I remember when I was reporting back in Australia, I used to do a lot of stories in the institute that we had down there. And I remember one time going when Mitch was coming through as a 19 or 20 year old from the institute, and they said he was the best keeper that they've ever had come through. And, it's been a lot of good Australian keepers that have come through and that set up. He's at a prime age now to come, and that's going to help with the issue that's the issue of every team that Kazama coaches, is that they're simply a side that's going to score more than they concede, and they'll do that and they'll get by. So having a brilliant goalkeeper there is going to help. They've just signed another young Brazilian guy who could be contender for a start straight away at the back, William Rock, who's not so young, he's in his mid-20s, inexperienced kind of head, who has obviously come in to help shore that area up as well. They've got some really exciting young talent there in the likes of Izumi and Aoki. And then the real final piece of the puzzle is Joe. I mean, you know, this is a guy that had, you know, we know he was had spells in Europe and he had a good spell in China as well. But he went back to Brazil and he tore the league to pieces last year. He was the leading scorer domestically in Brazil, you know, which is not an easy thing to do. And he's come here and I think he scored in every single preseason game that I've been able to find lineups and scorers for. This guy, I don't know the record of the all-time season record for goals in the J-League, but I'll make a serious bet with you that it's going to go this year, and it's going to be Joe that's going to get it. I mean, this guy could, I mean, he could score 40 goals. He could alone score more goals than many of the clubs at the bottom of the table will score. And this is a guy with a serious pedigree. He was obviously immediately, you know, slotted into the team, found form. He's got brilliant service behind him. And, I don't think there's a better striker in the league. So you've got one of the best keepers in the league. You've got, without question, the best striker. You've got one of the best coaches guiding it all, some brilliant young talent. You've got issues in defence, we know that. and they lost Taguchi, which is a blow, clearly, in central midfield. But I just think, you know, for a Kazama team, all the elements are there for his perfect kind of team to come up and immediately do very, very well.
Well, yeah, again, a compelling case, Sean. Any sort of pushback on that? I mean, yeah, they were scraping their way through the J2 playoffs, about 2 months ago, and now Scott's got them up in the top four. I mean, as he said, you know a lot more about Gabriel Xavier than most J1 observers, so I'm sure you'll be able to wax poetic about him. But from what you saw of the Nagoya squad in J2 last year, and obviously with some key additions who will have to bed into life in the J-League, but presuming they can do that relatively quickly, then the sky could be the limit. But what are your expectations for Grampus?
I'm just looking at the table from last year, the J1 table, and only five clubs scored 50 or more goals. So if Joe scores 50 goals on his own,
I almost said it was a shame that Kofu aren't in the league anymore because he would be a definite bet to outscore them. But in a lot of respects, it isn't a shame at all that Kofu aren't in the league anymore, is it?
No. It was Kawasaki, Kashima, Cerezo, Iwata scored 50, so I'll count them, and Urawa were the only teams that managed that. So, if Joe does that, he deserves the J1 shield all to himself. I wrote a piece, I don't know, maybe about a month ago, where I, very early on, looking at the transfers that had been made, and I said that I thought Nagoya could be a, like you said in your intro to them as well, it's maybe not an outside bet because of the amount of teams that have come up. Most recently, Cerezo, but Gamba did the same, Kashiwa Reysol did the same when they came out. It's not unheard of for promoted teams to settle straight back in. They could do very, very well. Defensively, they're not great, or they weren't last season anyway, but they got away with it because they were in J2 and they were just attacking pretty much the whole time. So while they did get caught out on occasion, they weren't ever really tested by any high quality opposition. That would be my worry for them this year, perhaps, that defensively those mistakes that they kind of maybe got away with last year, they'll be punished for against better opponents. But yeah, going forward, Scott mentioned the wide guys. I'm especially a big fan of Aoki. I think he's an excellent player. We could really go on to become a top player and possibly even challenge for the national team in time if he manages to maintain the promise he showed last year. Joe is gonna, you know, if you look at the kind of players that have done well in the J-League and scored, you know, I mean, Josh Kennedy was at Nagoya and filled his boots, and he was always a fairly, you know, he was a decent enough striker, but he never set the world alight before he came to Japan. Those kind of strikers that are physical and put themselves about will get goals in the J-League. Gabriel Xavier or Xavier or however you pronounce it was just a fantastic player. I don't have the stats in front of me, but I think he came in midway through last season and he managed to get something like 14 or 15 assists, and he was closing in on double figures for goals, and that's taken into account. He was out for at least a month, I think, with an injury. So he just, he was completely, playing way, way below his level last year. So the combination he could have with Joe up front I think they're going to cause a lot of J1 defences, a lot of problems this year. So, whether they'll be able to maintain it, and as I said, defensively, whether they'll have enough to really challenge, I'm not convinced, but I think they would be up there challenging for at least for the ACL. I think they'll finish top half comfortably, and then from there on, as it is every season, with 4, 5, 6 games to go, there could be half a dozen or more teams all within a point or two of each other. So I wouldn't have too many disagreements at all.
Indeed, fair enough. Yeah, well, I'd probably have them the highest placed of the three promoted teams, and therefore, it'd be at least the top half. But I'm not sure I can quite go as optimistically as Scott, and perhaps I'm slightly less optimistic as well than you are there, Sean. But they should be definitely entertaining to watch, and never a dull moment at the Toyota or the Mizuho this season, I'm sure. Okay, we'll save the other two promoted teams for a little bit later, I think, Scott. But in your top four there, you've left out two teams that made it last year, Sodeso and Kashiwa. So roughly where do you have them finishing in your predicted table?
The next two spots, actually, fifth and sixth. Kashiwa are just slightly ahead of Sodeso, although I can see, very strong reasons and arguments why the pink half of Osaka, there's no reason really why they can't, make it into the top. I just don't want to have to sit down and watch them do it with that kind of fairly sterile style of play every week. As a matter of fact, I think they're the perfect team that could do very well in the ACL. Actually, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they made a very strong run. Unless we forget, they're the reigning ACL champions. I did this unofficial kind of ACL thing where I track back to the club that won the very first match, and then, from there on, who kept winning and kept winning, and it's Sereza that are the current title holders. That was when the great Ranko Popovic was in charge, and that was a very different-looking Sereza team. But, I mean, they have all the elements, to be right up there in the top six, as do Akashwa, a very good squad, a nice mix of youth and experience, unless we forget the best goalkeeper anywhere in Asia in my boyfriend, Kosuke Nakamura, who I'm an unashamed a fan of. I think he's a wonderful player. It's still a little bit of a surprise for me that he's in Japan. And, if he goes to Russia and emerges as the number one, as he should, then, he might not be long for the league. He may not even come back for the second half of the season. And of course, that could have a huge impact on them. But, I understand why, if we look back 5, 6 years, that, someone like Cristiano is a maligned figure. But, those that are still maligning him probably haven't watched him very closely in the past 5 years, because he's a very, very impressive player. I'm saying improved or whatever, but I think he's one of the top, two or three foreigners in the league now. He's a superb creator. He's a superb finisher. He works very hard for the team, and he's an absolutely vital and influential cog in that side. And, really a very mature player now and a very fine player. So, they're always going to have goals. They've got good service coming from the wide areas, very good central midfielders, and even a guy like Tezuka, who was a big star in the first half of last year before he did his ACL, to come back into the mix as well. A very young but very exciting back line and that keeper as well. So if they can manage, the dual commitments that they have, domestically and then on Asia, there's no reason why they shouldn't be a top six. So.
All right, fair enough. And just for the record, Sean, do you have a boyfriend? Because you obviously...
I don't. Sean mentioned his boyfriend before.
Oh, Kento.
Yes.
Is Kento my boyfriend? I don't know. It doesn't count, though. It can't count, though, because I actually know him.
That's what I was going to say.
As you like going behind the curtain, Ben, I know you enjoy doing that on the sure. podcast. I'll have to let the listeners know that Scott is genuinely has a crush on this on Nakamura, because he was within touching distance of him at the aforementioned conference on more than one occasion. and he was too nervous to go
too
over.
Shy,
and,
really.
He was too shy and too nervous to go over and say hello to him. So yeah, it's genuine. This isn't just talk. He's genuinely got a crush on the Kashua Reysel goalkeeper.
That's a tremendous scoop. I very much appreciate you sharing that with the audience, Sean.
So to keep going behind the curtain, didn't you teach Kento and Misao English at one point? Is this?
I did. That's how I know him. I know him.
There you go.
For a mutual working link. His mum worked somewhere I worked, and I was told that her son wanted to learn English, and he was a footballer. So I said, okay, I'll give it a go. He was born in Japan, but he grew up in Canada until he was, I think, around about four.
Oh, really?
He grew up in Canada, so he already speaks reasonably good English. He's got the kind of the base there, and because he wants to go and play in Europe at some point, he wanted to keep working at his English. So for around about, I'd say maybe a year, maybe a little bit more. Yeah, maybe around about a year, just before he came through at Verdi, and then for his first season at Verdi, we'd meet up once a week, and I would help him with his English. And then once he moved to Kashima, I hit that on the head because I wasn't going to travel out to Kashima once a week. But he still gives it a go. And, yeah, his English is decent. And he said he watches a lot of things on Netflix with English subtitles to keep it up. So yeah,
are you officially claiming him as your boyfriend?
I wouldn't say that. No, like I said,
you're just friends.
We're just friends. Yeah, friends. And there are no.
You're in the friend zone. No, fair enough.
You're in the friend zone. I think the boyfriend thing has to be because for you and Scott, it's this unrequited. It's the thrill of the chase, isn't it? I don't think once you've met them, can they count as a boyfriend? I'm not sure.
Well, that's why I'm nervous because you've been keep telling me that Kosuke has zero personality. So I just don't want the bubble to burst. So I'm happy to be in his presence, but just
I'm not sure if he has zero personality, but he seems very, very shy, very within himself. Maybe it's just
pop. Hasn't met me yet. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, maybe once he meets you, it's all going to go downhill.
Goodness gracious me! All right, well, I think we might need to get back on track here, gentlemen. Let's move on, and we'll talk about the teams that finished. The other teams that finished in the top half of the table last season and what our expectations are for them in as much detail as you like. So we've basically covered last season's top five and Nagoya with a bit of Urawa thrown in there, obviously, with what they did in 2017. So from sixth placed Iwata through Reds, Tosu who finished eighth and Kobe ninth in 2017. Sean, which of those would you, I don't know, would you be expecting the most of this season, either in terms of moving up or down the table? I'll read them again, sorry. Iwata, Urawa, Tosu and Kobe.
Moving up, looking at those four, I would say Urawa, just because I think last year they put all their eggs in the ACL basket for the end of the season. They were barely making an effort in the league. I can't remember exactly how many it was, but they didn't win many in their last half a dozen games, or if not more. Iwata are one of those teams that I have to admit I always not avoid. What's the wrong way of putting it? I don't see them as often as I probably should. I was kind of surprised to see them up as high as they were, so I don't really know much about them. So I can't really bearing in mind the teams we've spoken about so far and the strength they've got, I'd be surprised if Iwata got much higher than they were last year. Tosu, again, are, as you two know well, on account of their manager having previously been at Tokyo, they're a steady, well-organized team who were built for mid-table and very rarely seem to be able to or really seem to want to push on beyond that. They're quite happy just being in J1 every year, I think. And Kobe, I don't know about Kobe. I mean, they obviously signed Podolski, which has got a lot of headlines and things like that. But if you sort of take a step back from it and look objectively, he's not, he's always been a good player. He's always done well. He played a lot for Germany, and you you're not a bad player if you've done that. But the hype around him maybe is slightly overdone, and to expect him to single-handedly drag a very mediocre club who have consistently underperformed for their means. I don't know. Even this year, their sign-ins have all been a bit of a hodgepodge, and doesn't really seem like there's much of a clear idea. The coach sort of underwhelmed a bit in his spell last year, and so I can't really see them finally making the jump up. So of those four, I'd plump for Reds, but I wouldn't expect any of those other three to drop off dramatically. I think they would still be floating around in the too good to go down, but not good enough to do anything serious category.
Fair enough. What do you reckon, Scott?
I've got one of them, actually, in my three relegation spots. So, yeah, correct. I'm absolutely not a fan of the way that the coach has them play. And I think they have a squad, although I recognise that the way he has them play means that they're very hard to beat, and you know they're quite strong at home, and they tend to pick up points. But the squad that they've got is just not very good. I mean, you look at it; it's a lot of recycled players. I mean, the left-sided midfield player Harakawa that they brought in finally permanently this year on loan from Kawasaki. They brought in Hideto Takahashi, who's recycled his way through a couple of clubs. Never seemed to get it going. They got rid of, to my surprise, Yohei Toyota, sent him off on loan to Korea after he had some kind of falling out, you know, in the second half of last year. He barely played since they brought in the big boy Ibaba, who looked like he brought a fair supply of food with him for the first month or two when he was here. He eventually got fit and managed to get about and make a bit of a nuisance of himself over the second half of the season. And, and then they've got a collection of it looks to me like a J2 squad, honestly. I mean, you know, looking at it from front to back, I mean, there's no real flair or creativity. I mean, the young guy Tagawa, who's been doing well for various youth teams with Japan, is a player of promise. And then you've got the other issues that we've seen with Tosu, you know, is a constant mid-season turnover of players, particularly the foreign players coming and going, more so than any other club outside of Corfu. And there may well be, you know, a common element between the way that those deals are done at those two clubs. And I don't know if that's the best thing for the long-term stability of the side. You know, they're good enough to grind out, you know, kind of results and finish 14th. But, you know, I just think there's too many other teams with too much around them. You know, I think this could be the year that they finally make the drop. Looking at that on the other side of the equation, Urawa continued to bring in, you know, fantastic players. And you look at this grouping of clubs. Urawa got arguably Kobe's best player in the defender, Iwanami, who's come over, who's likely to be a squad option at Reds. And in return, they sent over a squad option of theirs in Daisuke Nasu, who's likely to go to Kobe and be a starter. So that says, you know, kind of everything that you need to know about the two competing forces there. I mean, they've got they brought Takatomi in from Reysol, who, from what I'm hearing, is a possible contender.
Yeah, sneaky
to start.
Good signing.
You
know, yeah.
You might not see Muto starting for the team this year. They lost Rafael Silva, which is a big blow. He scored 12 goals for them last season, playing not as a striker. He played most of the season as a winger. So to do that, and he was, of course, a force of nature in the ACL, really the main reason they did what they did. They replaced him with Martinez, a similar player, but probably not quite in the same vein. And then what happens with Abe? I mean, he's no longer the captain. They've made Kashiwaga the captain. From the people that I've been speaking to, the expectations that Abe is not going to start this year, that you might then, you know, see he's not young anymore. Is he too young? But Endo has stayed right back, Guardian at left back. It just looks for me like an unbalanced kind of side, that they have the talent, absolutely no question, but I question whether the players are being used in the correct manner. I mean, this is a team, you know, that we shouldn't forget that for the long time had played with three central defenders, the four flat midfield options and the three in advance of them. And as a result, the squad had been built for a long period of time to those kind of strengths, and they never had natural fullbacks in that setup. That Makino kind of pigeonholed into one. Last year, they had Abe playing their points, have now got Endo playing points. So I look at the squad and I think they don't have fullbacks. Young Endo is not a fullback, never. Ugarjin for mine is not a fullback either. The central defender, Maurizio, he's got a wonderful beard. I'm a fan of beards. But as a footballer, I'm just not sure that he's up to J1 level. So, whereas, you know, maybe other players are. I mean, Iwanami clearly is, but are we now saying because we've got the, you know, the foreign option there, he's going to start ahead of him? So they've got the players. They've bought a guy that I've been a huge fan of for a long time, young Yamada, who was at Shonan in their promotion campaign last year, and I think the year before as well, has come back. You know, perhaps should start, but may not start. Then what happens up front? You've got Kuroki scored a hell of a lot of goals for them last year. What happens if he goes down? Who are the other options? I don't know. I mean, Tadanari Lee has potential. I don't know if Zlatan's going to be there or not be there. And what's the options behind that? So they've got depth in most positions. They've got question marks in some. And a coach who I don't think is up to it. So, yeah, it's a whole lot of questions. So it wouldn't, you know, I honestly think they'll stay. I had them seventh, which is exactly where they finished last year. Just quickly, Colbert, I think, have the ability to finish fourth, and they have the ability to finish 14th. And I think a lot of it hinges, as Sean said, on Podolski, because it's not just the player that, I mean, they've made him captain this year. So we saw a lot of histrionics from him last year when he came in, which are the kind of things that maybe you can get away with, well, not maybe, certainly in a European setting where you come in and you know, you're the main kind of guy and you're obviously cut above everyone else. We know that. But here in Japan, you need to be maybe a little bit more humble, certainly in the public arena that is the football pitch, in how you display, you know, perhaps some of those things. I mean, the clear and open frustration and actually, let's not beat around the bush, beratement of his teammates during games was not a good look last year. And you've got to wonder, you know, just how that kind of all went down with the teammates. And then the fact that the club's made him captain this year, it's basically that they've handed over the keys to him. So it's all going to hinge on what happened. Then, you know, all these stories at the end of the year when, you know, they were involved in the cup games that he wasn't in. Was he in Japan? Was he somewhere else? Could the club contact him? Could they not? You know, all sorts of issues outside of that, you know, around the upper echelons, you know, of the club and the coaching staff and who's actually making decisions in terms of matchday substitutions and all these kind of things that we hear about in China. You know, there's certainly been suggestions put to me that happens in Kobe. So I think there's a whole lot of you know, concerns with that club. If Podolski fires, they could be a very, you know, they could have a very good season. I mean, they've got, you know, other players kind of, I think Sean said, you know, strange kind of signings. Wellington, the guys, you know, has done well. At J2 level may not quite be that thing. Leandro's coming back from this long-term injury. What happens to him? They got rid of Nilton, a fantastic player, but they brought in the Korean guy, Jung, who's been here before, is a very good player as well. So they have some quality in positions, but it's all going to depend, I think, on Mr. Podolski and how he fares. And is the other one in that mix, Jubilo?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think it was a massive overachievement for them to get where they did last year. In many ways, a similar kind of side with perhaps a similar kind of mentality from the coaching element of it to Tosu. I think I had them slotted in at 11th. So, you know, I think they'll slide slightly, but yeah, probably not in danger of relegation, but I don't think in danger of really, you know, having a serious tilt at the ACC.
Yeah, I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on Iwata, but it was a really strange season. They won away at Kawasaki, Kashima, and Reds, but drew 10 times, including 6 times 0-0. So, yeah, difficult team to figure out. And, I mean, you know, finishing 6th after 13th the season before was a good effort. But, yeah, I think there probably will be a year regression to the mean, and mid-table's probably the best that Jubilo could hope for. Of the teams that finished in the top half in 2016, the two biggest falls last season were, of course, by Gunma Osaka, who basically went in the tank in the second half of the season and ended up 10th. A lot of that might be to do with the fact that the news that Kenta Hasegawa was leaving leaked out well before the season finished. Whether you believe that plays into the mindset of the players who actually go out on the pitch and play or not. And, of course, Hiroshima, who just narrowly dodged the relegation bullet in the relegation zone for so many weeks last season, finally escaping with a couple of late wins over Kobe and FC Tokyo, secured their survival with 1 week to go, but finished 15th in the table. Sean, of those two recent J1 powerhouses who were in slightly unfamiliar territory, at least in the past few seasons of being in the bottom half of the table, either or both of those spark your interest as a team that might be able to work their way back into the top half of the table and maybe even nudge the ACL places?
I think of those two, you'd have to say Gamba looked the more likely. Hiroshima seemed very much to have fallen back down to after a, what would you say, 4 or 5 years in the sun of really under Moriyasu, really kind of developing into one of the big teams, and you know, a challenge. Yeah, I'd say what, half a decade or so, they were up there challenging for the title and whatnot. They really seem to have reverted now. I mean, you've only got to look at the fact they've bought in Joe Fuku, who's sort of the definition of a muck. Would you say, politely?
There's a lot of things we could say, sure.
There's a lot.
I'll just say muck.
Could say. Just very like unimaginative, uninspiring. If you were a fan, you'd wonder. I mean, Hiroshima have spoken a lot about the. And from Petrovic leading through to Moriyasu, they had a similar thing to what Scott was mentioning with Kawasaki, where, okay, it's a different style of football, but they had a way of playing that came through from the youth teams, and they would develop players through that to play in a certain way with the three at the back and whatever. And now they've had Jonsson for a bit, that just about managed to keep them up. They've decided to bin him and now bring in Jolfuku, who doesn't play that type of football, from what I've ever seen of his teams. It seems like they're now just in it, a bit like I mentioned with Tosu before. They'd be content to just to stay up, to be in J1, to not drop down. So I can't really see them pushing on much beyond. I'd be surprised if they were really, really scrapping against relegation the same way as they did last year. But I can't really see them going back up to where they were a few years ago. Whereas Gamba have still got some very good players. They've brought in a coach who's always done well, previously obviously with rival Cereza, but Livir Kolpi will come in and get them organised, get the players playing for him. They've still got a lot of talent there. They've brought in some decent players. I think Yajima, the signing they made from Reds, was a bit of a surprise one, but I think he's an excellent player who could really go on and in time take over from Endo if and when he decides to hang up his boots. Of those two, I would say Gamba are the more likely to push on, yeah.
All right, Scott. Well, there. What about Hiroshima, Gamba? And I guess we can extend our net a bit wider now to some of the other teams that finished in the bottom half last season. There's, of course, Sapporo matching their best ever J1 finisher by finishing 11th, Sendai Tokyo and Shimizu, finishing from 12th to 14th in the table, just above Hiroshima. So, feel free to take on any or as many of those as you like.
Yeah, I agree with Sean. I think Gamba, I've got them slotted down in 8th on my little ranking thing here. I agree, a vastly experienced coach who knows what to do. He'll come in and stabilise them. And I think what you said was exactly correct, that, you know, the last 2-3 months of the season was almost a write-off. You know, they fell out of the cups, then the news about Hasegawa coming in. It was almost a sense that everybody just wanted to get the thing out of the way. You know, no one knew who the coach was going to be. And if you believe the whispers doing rounds, this is probably only going to be a short-term stint for Kolpi before Tsuneyasu. Miyamoto takes over. Was my understanding that he was due to take over probably a year earlier than this, but it's been pushed back, so you know he has a chance to look and learn under a really experienced guy before he probably takes the reins of them next year, or perhaps if things go pear-shaped at some point throughout this year. But you know, they have some brilliant young players. Of course, we've seen many of them flee the nest, but certainly throughout pre-season, young Ichimaru has been handed a lot of opportunities, and you know, he might envy a Smokey for a start, you know, alongside that experience. In midfield, I have real kind of question marks about the front line. You know, a collection of players that are good, but you know, you can they're no Joe. There's no one that's going to score 50 goals in the Gamba side. Sapporo, another vastly experienced managerial change. Petrovic coming in. You know, I mean, how that dynamic plays out is going to be interesting to watch, because Yamada was the coach. I think Misha originally came as some kind of sporting director. That was very quickly changed, and then Yamada is still there on the staff as whatever they call it in Japan, the head coach. So it's an interesting backroom situation, but, you know, they've got wonderful talent in key positions. I mean, Chanaksip came in, the Thai player last year, and did fantastically well. Jay, when he's fit, it is an issue of how often he's going to be there. But when he's there, he's without question one of the best finishers in Japanese. And if he stays healthy for the whole season, I mean, he's not going to be in the Joe territory, but he's going to be up there. You know, I mean, it wouldn't surprise if he's amongst the top two or three. Scores a fantastic player, you know, comfortable in the air and on the ground as well. So they have and a fantastic young keeper as well, the Korean guy, who I like at the back very much. So I've got them down at ninth. Of the other collection, Shimizu I've got in 12th, which we can tie in with Hiroshima, because I think it was an absolute disgrace what happened with the club. You know, they had a change of general manager or the board or whatever at the end of last season, and then, you know, the Jan Jonsson, who's not quite in my boyfriend territory, but he's very close, because he's a very enigmatic kind of character. I like very much Mochiron, that he litters his post-match interviews with Japanese and English, and I told him this at the kickoff conference. He was very surprised that I'd noted such a thing. But he did a wonderful job. I mean, really, a very kind of gutsy and brave move to change the way that they've played structurally, you know, for such a long time, to come in, move it straight away to a 4-4-2, and then really had the team humming by the end of the season. They were playing some very good football, you know, over the last, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. And to be treated the way he was, I thought, was a disgrace by the club, particularly given the level of a replacement that they brought in. So I think Shimizu are a contender to stabilise this year. You know, I don't think they'll be in serious danger of relegation. They've got a wonderful player in Chris Lahn, who was, in my opinion, criminally underused at Sendai last year. I don't know what the hell happened between him and Watanabe up there, because he was far and away the best, not just the best striker they had, but he was one of the best strikers in the league. I mean, every time he came on, they looked like a totally different team. So for Shimizu to be able to get a guy like that, I think he's on loan. I think he's on loan from Sendai, maybe, or some weird situation. And then Sendai have gone and brought in this 20-year-old Brazilian kid on loan for only until May. So I don't know what's going on with that club. But if Chris Lahn, you know, settles right in, and by all accounts he's been doing pretty well in pre-season, playing alongside Chong Tesser with, you know, Mitch Duke, the Australian international, has really come on. They've got the Shirasaki there as well, and a couple of other, you know, really good options. Reasonably well stocked, you know, from a second half of the table side. Defensively, I think they at least stabilise. You know, they may even be able to push a bit higher than that. And who else we got in this? I've got Hiroshima down at 15th, just escaping a relegation. They've made some good signings. Tirasin coming in, looks like he's going to be their first choice forward. The Thai international's got a prolific record at club level and national level for Thailand as well, and he seems to be settling in right. I had a brief word with him at the kickoff conference as well. You know, seems to be loving life down there. So, you know, if he can come and score for them, it's going to be a key to helping them. But I just can't, get over the fact that, I mean, again, they look to, they're a similar side to Reds in a way that they seem to be pigeonholing players into, you know, perhaps unfamiliar positions or positions where they're not best suited. They don't seem to have natural fullbacks either. I think they're going to struggle.
And in a word, FC Tokyo?
I think FC Tokyo are going to struggle. as much as it pains us to say it as well, we've got now a coach coming in Hasegawa, of course, who's been a serial winner. I mean, he's won a lot, and he's, you know, had his teams playing fairly positively throughout his time as well. The question at Tokyo is just the squad. I mean,
it's just so middling again.
Again, you look at it. In most positions, you can make an argument that it's very close to a J2 squad. I mean, you know, I think one very good defender in the Korean Jungle is the new captain of the club, Morishige, returning from injury, could potentially help a central midfield. They look very weak. They look very weak in the wide roles in what looks to be a 4-4-2. And then up front, if, you know, we believe the situation that Roichi Maeda at 36 is going to be the answer, I'm not quite sure what the question is. And these seeming, you know, endless stream of loan deals. I mean, Young Togashi is a player of promise, but why he was brought in only on loan, I believe, from Yokohama. And then Diego Oliveira, Oliveira again, a player of promise who looked good, but he also looked like he'd been borrowing some food from our friend down in Tosu in the off-season. Some very unflattering photos of him. And again, he's only come in on loan. So I keep saying, you're the only club in the top flight of the world's largest city. You shouldn't be going around and picking up scraps from other clubs. You should have a proper scouting network in place that that brings through you know, top quality players and then young players pushing out. The great hope, of course, is what happens with Young, the star of the national team, the Barcelona prodigy, and everyone's favourite young player Takafusa Kubo, who's been heavily involved in preseason, and you know, we might see get immediate starts off the bench. But geez, you know, look at the age difference. Imagine if Kubo and Maeda are playing together. You've got a 36-year-old playing.
Well, I was going to say Maeda's a granny that Yuma Suzuki could certainly nudge out of the way, yeah. No problem.
Yes, exactly. He would be the guy that Suzuki would be pushing
out. Indeed, indeed.
So yeah, I just think the squad is very, very ordinary, and it's really amazing that they haven't you know, gone and recruited more high profile. I mean, even a player like Yuma Suzuki. I mean, I don't understand why on earth we're getting, you know, someone like Diego Oliveira on loan. He's a good player. He's a good finisher, you know, inside the six-yard box if he gets a service. It's questionable whether he's going to get it if Diego Higashi is one of your wingers. but a guy like Suzuki, you know, we could have got...
What am I, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, there's so many things we could have done. I think they're probably going to have just enough to escape relegation, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if they were flirting with it
yes,
for very long.
Fair enough. Yeah, I can't say I've had any optimism at all myself when it comes to FC Tokyo's prospects this season. Let's wrap it up, Sean, by talking about the other two promoted teams. Of course, we've already mentioned Nagoya. We all think that they're decent bets for a top-half finish this year. What about J2 champions Shonan? Will they go close to matching their eighth-place finish from 2015, or will it be more like 2016 when they were relegated, of course, a yo-yo team in recent years? Or what about Nagasaki, promoted to the top flight for the first time ever, of course, after finishing second in J2 last season? You will have seen a lot of those two teams last year, obviously. How do you think they'll get on back in the top flight in Shonan's case and for the first time in Nagasaki's?
I think if we go for Nagasaki first, they're going to struggle. I think it's obvious, you know, everyone's picking them straight away as the side to be favourites to go down. But I think based on the way they play, they're kind of the opposite of what I said about Nagoya. Whereas Nagoya always had enough firepower to get away with their defensive mistakes, Nagasaki were very well organised defensively, really hard to break down. But they kind of struggled to, they didn't really carry much of a scoring threat. They were sort of eke out 1-0 wins or pick up draws, and they were very well organised defensively, and I think they will struggle to remain so tight at the back against stronger opponents in the top flight, especially bearing in mind the fact they still don't have a great deal going forward. Juanma, who is a decent enough striker, but I'm not really sure if he's got the mobility to really punish defences in J1, and especially not on his own. He was playing sort of one up top with a couple of attacking midfielders in behind him last year, and I can't really see Varen doing a great deal. I mean, they could avoid the drop because, you know, we've seen teams previously, I don't know, like Tosu or someone, that have come up and just tried to stabilise first of all. So they could do, but I'd be surprised, to be honest, if they weren't going back down. And Shonan, I'm a big fan of Shonan, and I'm a big fan of their coach Chokije. I love the way that he sets the team up, and his enthusiasm for trying to play positive football when in possession. He's another one I spoke to last week, and I asked him, you know, what were they going to try and do things differently to last time, because they obviously came up the last time they were promoted with having just completely blitzed the second division and then tried to become a little bit more cautious and defensive in the top flight, and it didn't work out for them. And I just think he said that they, you know, he knows they need to be the thing they're good at moving the ball around and things. He said the thing they really need to improve on is their sort of one-on-ones, that players actually taking on the opposition and trying to get in behind, and that he feels that bringing in the likes of Umesaki, even Mikic, who obviously is getting on in years, but despite that has always put in a shift out wide for Hiroshima and been positive going forwards. So I think Shonan, looking at their squad as well, you know, they've got a lot of quality in there. They've got youngsters, they've got experience. So I think they're far better equipped to stay up. I don't think they'll push on too high. I mean, they could do if they got off to a good start. There's no reason why they couldn't if they clicked into gear. But yeah, I think they should be safe enough from relegation. But for Varin, unfortunately, I think it could be quite a long season.
Fair enough. And I've just asked you about Shonan and Nagasaki, and just realised that you'll be watching them in the flesh on Saturday afternoon, Sean. You mentioned before we started recording you were off to Hiratsuka on the weekend, and yes, Nagasaki are the visitors.
Yes, I will indeed. So I'll report back after Nagasaki win 5-0 and blow all of my predictions
terrific
out
stuff,
of the water,
yeah,
on the opening weekend, which is what
indeed overreaction theatre on the next week's episode of J Talk. So yeah, wrapping it up, Scott. What are your thoughts on both Shonan and Nagasaki?
I agree with Sean. I very much am a fan of Chokui J, the Belmare coach. I like the philosophy and the way that he has his teams playing. The question is what they kind of learned. You know, I mean, last time they came up, they played basically the same way, but with a limited squad. You know, they come up this time, in my opinion, with a limited squad again. And you know, how he perhaps tempers some of those natural attacking tendencies might be the key. I mean, speaking honestly, there's probably a lack of class right across the squad. They lost two of their three leading scorers last year, so how that's replaced is a key. They brought Lee Jung-hook, the Korean, who comes with a decent pedigree, but probably not much more, and the cupboard's essentially bare behind him. So, you know, it could be a real issue if he doesn't click and fire. And I mean, Masaki's a player, okay, has quality, but, you know, maybe almost as a J2 player, I think. So the squad doesn't look particularly good to me, but I think they have the coach to be able to overcome that. I had them slotted down in 13th. One club that we didn't really touch on, I had in the drop zone along with Tosu, is Sendai. I think this could be the year, again, when they really fall. A coach that we've always heard kind of, you know, talk about wanting to play this attacking football, and then you sit down and watch it, and you're watching the total opposite. So I'm not quite sure sometimes if, you know, I'm watching the same game that he's out there watching. A limited squad, very surprising move, getting rid of Pusan, bringing in this young Brazilian. So I think this could be the year that Sendai go down. And I think there's no question whatsoever that Nagasaki are going to go down. And I think they could. Was it Tokushima that had the lowest ever points, or whenever that was in?
Yeah, Tokushima or Oita, I think. They've both been horrible in the last 5 or 6 years, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's a great story. You know, we love to see small clubs coming up, and, you know, they've got whatever, a decent, you know, passionate local, you know, supporter base. And they brought in a guy that I know from Australia, Ben Haller, and is one of those creative kind of players. You know, he's going to have an important role to play if he can adjust. But I just think they have a squad that, they have a coach that was only been, what, 1 year experience in J1 football, and that was the year that he got Yokohama FC relegated in record time. I think that was actually the record for 10 years in terms of how quickly they went down. They went down quicker than anyone else. So it's not a great, you know, historical parallel to have that same coach now coming up and trying to do it again 10 years later. Obviously, he's improved in that time. But I think not only will they go down, I think they'll probably be one of the worst teams that we've ever seen in Japan.
All right. Well, yeah, not great prospects for Nagasaki, you wouldn't think. But, well, stranger things have certainly happened in J1 recent history than them surviving. So they'll certainly give it a crack. And, yes, we shall see how the J1 first-timers get on. Scott, you mentioned that you've had your table scratched out, obviously with the potential to change it before everything gets going on Friday night. But what I'd suggest is you, as soon as we finish on the pod, get onto Twitter and use hashtag JPred to get on at Giffy Richie's J League predictions slash competition. Oh, nice. Not really a competition, but yeah, Richie does it for S's and G's and gets lots of people responding. He's after, I think, a top four and a bottom three in J1, a top six in J2, and a bottom two in J2, and maybe a top four in J3. So if you, the listeners want to get involved, obviously you don't have to submit entries for all three divisions or all of them. I saw that... I saw, Scott, that our mate Graham, his J prediction was simply FC Tokyo to finish 11th. That's it. He didn't bother with anything else. yeah, that's something for the listeners to do in the days leading up to kick off on Friday night is, yeah, on Twitter, hashtag JPred. Thanks again to Giff and Richie for getting that done. Okay, we'll wrap it up, guys, with a look at the schedule for match day one of the 2018 J1 season. It all gets going on Friday night with Tosu hosting Kobe. Four games on Saturday. FC Tokyo host Urawa. Hiroshima at home against Sapporo. Gamba host Nagoya, and Shonan will entertain Nagasaki with Sean Carroll watching on. Then on Sunday, it's Sendai hosting Kashiwa. Shimizu at home against Kashima Antlers. Iwata versus Kawasaki at the Ekopa. And the late afternoon game on Sunday is Cerezo Osaka hosting Yokohama. A decent shout there probably for the game of the round. Two teams that finished in the top five last season, although, yes, as we mentioned earlier on, Cerezo will be without Hiroshi Kiyotake for this game and, yeah, at least the first month of the season. So, Sean will be at Hiratsuka. Are you going to a J1 game on the weekend, Scott?
For my sins, Ben, I may very well head along to FC Tokyo and Urawa. Will you be joining?
I will not, unfortunately, no. Have not made plans for a leave pass on that day. I'd say unfortunately, but probably fortunately for me, because we usually lose at home to Reds, don't we? And I can't really see that pattern changing on Saturday. But, well, a new season, you never know. All right, well, guys, I've kept you for far longer than I'd anticipated, but I'm sure the listeners are very, very appreciative of all of your insight into what's sure to be a fascinating 2018 season. So, Scott, thank you very much for guesting on this J1 season preview. And, yes, all the best for the continuing success of the Asian game. And please send my regards to Paul Williams.
Will do. Thanks a lot. It's been great fun to come along and chat about Japanese football. The pub was such an important, you know, way of linking people both inside and outside of Japan who like and follow Japanese football.
So terrific. Thanks, mate. And, yes, Sean, yeah, terrific to have you back on again. And the listeners can no doubt read your work in the weeks to come on Football Channel.
Yes, they can. That's where it'll mostly be. They'll, fingers crossed, there'll occasionally be things in the paper as well, in the Japan news, and here, there and everywhere, basically. Bits here and there. But, yeah, mostly on Football Channel. So, yeah, that's it. And, yeah, just to echo what Scott said, I'm really pleased that you've brought the pod back this year, because it is a great way to keep up to speed with what's going on and hear from people who are genuinely passionate about and know what they're talking about in most cases when it comes to the J-League.
Indeed. Well, thanks very much, Sean, and yeah, indeed, Scott, as well, for your nice words there. Thank you both for guesting on this, the J1 season preview episode, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. We'll be back to round up a big first weekend of the J1 and J2 seasons next week. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast.
Yes.